Hey, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Solari Report. We are joined today by Dr. Richard Warner, extraordinary scholar, PhDs from Oxford, but tremendous experience both in academia and the private sector. And I think, Richard, it's that combination of practical experience in the markets and with business, combined with incredible research on the economy that gives you a great advantage, including talking about topics like disaster capitalism and economic warfare, which we're talking about today. So we just did an interview on the Solari Report with you about building growth, and it was a wonderful conversation about how, in fact, tremendous growth with inflation and wealth is possible, and it sort of cuts through many of the lies we're told. Part of the lies we're told center around the fact that there is a systematic effort to accumulate assets and control by the means of economic warfare. So we see, you know, lots of talk these days about either shock doctrine or takings. And as you know, I'm very concerned that that's going to accelerate or is accelerating in both Europe and the United States and the Western world. So I wanted to talk with you today about some of the historical case studies and help people begin to understand the model of how economic warfare and economic takings occur and see it, you know, sort of in many of the examples we know and that you've studied, and from that get an understanding of some of the tactics that are used or might be used on us. Mm-hmm. So first of all, let me just say thank you. I see you're coming to us from Bavaria, and it's one of my favorite places in the world. It's very beautiful there. Okay, so case studies. When did you first become aware of sort of economic warfare? Was it your study on Japan, your very famous book, Princes of the Yen, or did it come before then?
No, it was for the research for that book. But of course, that research started in the 1990s. And I essentially I wrote several books, some of which are not yet published. And then, you know, one outcome is Princes of the Yen. I have to get back to the other parts, particularly the case studies I did, historical case studies on these mechanisms that had been deployed earlier on Germany already in the 1920s and 30s. Mm-hmm. And so really, basically, it depends, you know, the type of economic warfare and the particular features are dependent on the extent of control that the key players, decision makers already have and can deploy in that country. And that determines what sort of techniques they're going to apply. In some cases, when they actually manage to already be on the ground, maybe even control the central bank, that opens up a whole range of possibilities. And that was the situation in Germany in the 1920s, and it was the situation in Japan. And it was also, as it turns out, and perhaps lesser known, the situation in the East Asian financial crisis, the financial crisis in Asia, 1997, 1998. I showed there that the central bankers were the traitors working for the, you know, these foreign decision makers to hand over their countries to them. In fact, the model they used in Thailand was the German model of 1920s, 1930s, same mechanism. And of course, in Germany, the foreigners had formal control over the central bank since 1923. Right. That was a big turning point. I mean, first of all, one should be aware that the German central bank, the Reichsbank, which was the central bank since its founding in 1876, was 100% privately owned. Mm-hmm. And that's not so well known. Certainly in Germany, it's never been made a topic of public awareness or discussion or debate at all. Most people are not aware of that. That, of course, already means there's, you know, a small group of people who have a high degree of control over the central bank. But the government during the First World War essentially encroached on the central bank quite a bit And I suppose the central bankers and the owners of the central bank decided, okay, we have to get rid of this government influence on the central bank, make it independent from the government. And in fact, they decided we want it independent and unaccountable, independent from and unaccountable to any institution in Germany, not just the government, but also the parliament. There's no democratic assembly at all that the Reichsbank is accountable was accountable to in this right. legal change from 1923 onwards. There was a legal change to its, you know, its status, and that was agreed between Germany and the essentially occupying, well, you know, the victors after the First World War, partly Germany's foreign occupied, and so it was decided then that the central bank would be taken out of any German control. Later, this model was used for other central banks. So the Reichsbank was based in Berlin, but it was turned effectively into an international institution that was not accountable to any German institutions, but accountable entirely to foreign players, namely initially the J.P. Morgan Reparations Committee. You know, there was this reparations committee, which was dominated by J.P. Morgan, because actually the reparations were officially to England and France, but in reality, these countries were indebted to J.P. Morgan. And so right. it's, you know, it was quite well known that it was dominated by J.P. Morgan, because J.P. Morgan is the biggest creditor. Britain had made J.P. Morgan not only the source of its funds by borrowing from them, but at the same time, they appointed this J.P. Morgan as the procurement agent for the British government for armaments and any procurement, military procurement at the same time. So, right. of course, that was a nice position to be in, and J.P. Morgan took great advantage of that. But it then also became, after the First World War, in charge of the German economy through its control of the so-called Reparations Committee. That Reparations Committee was then later, 1930, turned into an institution known as the Bank for International Settlement.
Right.
And of course, that's the, you know, the central bank of central banks, of these core founding central banks. And so what is the track record of that committee and later the BIS? Well, as soon as they took control of the Reichsbank, they also, well, they essentially launched the hyperinflation. That was when the Reichsbank was under control of the Reparations Committee.
Right.
That's when the hyperinflation was launched. And of course, that is a form of economic warfare of a very high degree, very aggressive level that essentially destroyed the middle class and really caused very large degree of economic dislocation
right.
by devaluing money. And anyone who had liquid assets, you know, just lost their savings, lost their money.
Well, and they had to dispose of their assets to survive.
Exactly.
So a lot of times, right. So you're delivering a shock, of which hyperinflation is absolutely one of the traditional ones. And what it does is it basically forces a mass shift of ownership of assets.
Exactly. And of course, this situation was very, very bad, because during this hyperinflation, a lot of people were extremely poor. They lost all their savings. You know, there were some that had just sold their house, and so all the money was going up in smoke, you know, nothing, worth mm-hmm. nothing. It can be illustrated, as I do in my book, Princes of the Yen, at quantumpublishers.com. You can get it. Amazon won't sell you the original. They will charge a fortune, by the way. Amazon, that is. Go to Quantum Publishers. It's quite cheap there. If you look at the descriptions by the Japanese central bankers, there was a key central banker actually at the Reichsbank training with Hjalmar Schacht, the Reichsbank president, who had been creating this, you know, been involved in this economic dislocation. And He later became governor of the Japanese Central Bank. But in his memoirs, generally available in Japanese, I mean, I found some shocking descriptions of how he, as a central banker in Germany in 1923, he really enjoyed his time. It was a fun time. It was amazing because all these poor people, you know, they had essentially no food. All the women, the housewives, had to sell themselves for almost nothing. And he enjoyed just spending, you know, a few yen, essentially hiring these women. So, yeah, it's pretty shocking, actually, you think about it, how these central bankers can take easily advantage of these situations. So it was quite a dire situation.
Right.
And at the same time, if you look at the bigger picture, what happened in the 20s was it was still only setting the stage for the even bigger sort of coup de grace, where you'd essentially just blow the economy entirely out of the water. Namely, during the 20s, the Reichsbank under Schacht made the country increasingly dependent on foreign money, which never makes any sense. You know, this it's just...
Right.
But, of course, in official economics, the story is always, well, you need investment, so you need money. Oh, you don't have enough in the country. Well, the foreigners can give it to you.
Welcome to the debt trap.
Exactly. And, of course, that's how developing countries are being kept under...
a lot of times the
exploitation.
The local leadership gets chosen and promoted because they're willing to put their country in a debt trap.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Right. Well, we'll come back to the developing countries because that's when I realized, you know, really how they go about this economic warfare. And so in the German situation, they once, because when you have control of the central bank, then you can move to these policies that normally would not happen if you have people in charge that are somewhat looking to, you know, the local domestic interest.
So let me just insert one thing, because it was clear if you look at the discussions coming up to the creation of the BIS, that they were adamant that they needed, you know, the guys at the Bank of England were adamant, we want a central bank that has sovereign immunity. How can we persuade everybody to go along? And the reparations were the way, because essentially the first task of the BIS was to manage the reparations. But of course, that went away relatively quickly. But then you have a central bank of central banks that can move money under the equivalent of total secrecy and above the law. And even better, it can hold assets on its balance sheet with no disclosure.
Yes.
So you have the perfect pipes for playing this game globally, anywhere you want to go in and do it.
That's right. That's right. And
right.
Of course, the BIS has immunity. No public prosecutor, no law, no court can get to them, no matter what happens. And of course, you know, this worked very well even during the Second World War. So while the countries were at war, the bankers of Germany, France, Britain, and the U.S. sat on the same table and had their discussions how we're going to shift money, literally. So
right.
Can't make it up. And of course, you know, Germany reporting back to the BIS, well, actually, we've just taken the Czech gold reserve. So, you know, just Bank of England, you've got to move them over from your Czech account of gold holdings to the German account of gold holdings, please. Okay, yes, sir, no problem. You know,
right.
And so on. I mean, all sorts of things happening there during the World War. And you realize, well, hang on, why should the soldiers go out there and kill each other? You know, the bankers seem quite happy to talk to each other, rather.
Right. I love the stories of Alan Dulles being in Basel and during the war and laundering money back and forth for various corporations between the two sides.
Absolutely. Exactly.
You see it all. Right.
Exactly. Well, and of course, that started already during the First World War. They realized that that's the way to go. In fact, the creation of some of the key central banks clearly was already influenced by the timetable they had in mind, particularly the Federal Reserve.
Right.
because it was clear to them, well, we can only really do this properly and also exploit the U.S. economy properly if we have a privately owned central bank in America. And if you think about it, I mean, it's an extraordinary situation. Here is this central bank, the new central bank, Federal Reserve, just created, actually, ultimately, during 1914. I mean, the act was passed at the end of 1913, but really it was created in 1914, just in time for the beginning of the First World War, because America joined later, being persuaded by the bankers, really, and various staged events like, the Lusitania sinking, which essentially the British made sure would be sunk. They essentially told the captain, we know where the German U-boats are. You've got to go this way so that you get sunk and we can then scream and shout about it. While the British had registered it as an auxiliary military ship, and the German government had said and had put, big ads into American newspapers, don't board it. We will try to sink it. They shouldn't board any civilians because they registered it as a military ship. And the Germans were going by the book, it's registered as a military ship. So anyway, but so then once America joined, you had this extraordinary situation that the key central banker, the privately owned Deutsche Reichsbank, was somebody called Max Warburg, who was director at the Reichsbank, while the guy who founded, essentially wrote the constitution of the Federal Reserve and was a key director of the Federal Reserve. He never became chairman of the Board of Governors, or initially there wasn't even a Board of Governors, but he always sort of stayed slightly second role, but he was the mover and shaker behind the scenes, was somebody called Paul Warburg, his brother. So these two countries were at war while the key central bankers were brothers, and that's that's of course how they continued with the BIS. So the mechanism they then unfolded, because they had control over the Reichsbank in the 20s and really launched this hyperinflation. Then they had a strict credit control regime. And then they said, we need dollars. We need to dollarize the German economy. That's the best way, and so on. So by the end, by around 1930, almost 50% of the short-term deposits of the big five Berlin banks, top German banks, were U.S. dollar-denominated short-term deposits, short-term loans from the U.S., which, of course, pull any time. And that's time bomb they set, Schach himself set in the German banking system. He then resigned. He sort of lit the fuse, and then he resigned. And it takes a while, it took a year for this to blow up, but he was no longer head of the German Central Bank. And then it blew up. And of course, that's how the, the Great Depression, the collapse of the banking system in the U.S. was exported to Germany. Mm-hmm. Because the moment then there was a banking crisis first in the U.S., the U.S. banks pulled out those loans. And the German Central Bank then insisted, no, you have to make good on these. Okay, you have to do whatever it takes. So the German bank said, okay, well, then we have to pull out our loans from German industry. And that's how in one go you pull the rug of the entire economy. All the German companies had suddenly their loans liquidated under some clauses. But of course, they were invested in their machinery and production. And so they had to suddenly close down and flog the assets. So you had in one go massive thousands of companies going bankrupt and large-scale unemployment overnight. As you first introduce a dollar, then you pull it out, and everyone insisted, no, we have to make good on it. You could just say, well, sorry, but we don't have the money, but we're not going to pay this. But of course, Germany was not in that situation because foreigners were controlling the central bank since 1923. And so that's how the Great Depression was very effectively exported to Germany as well, and then therefore to continental Europe. And then you had 25%, close to 30% unemployment and economic destitution in Germany as well. So that mechanism is a very strong one, and it only works if you have your people on the ground at the central bank insisting on these things.
Right.
That was the same thing they did in the Asian crisis with the Thai central bank, the Korean central bank, and also Indonesian central banks, essentially playing ball and adopting the same policies as I just described for Germany. So Thailand became artificially dependent on short-term dollar lending, which made no sense.
So you had these incredible short-term loans, which China avoided doing, getting external short-term loans. And then you pull the liquidity, and then suddenly, bam, everybody's got to sell their equity. And
exactly.
You saw a movement of Western investors in picking up incredible equity positions for pennies on the dollar.
Indeed.
And you saw it in situations where normally, you know, as a matter of politics, you wouldn't be allowed to buy a controlling interest. But suddenly Westerners were allowed to buy controlling interests. It was astonishing.
Yes, that's exactly the situation. The situation in Thailand, of course, and there you can see how the central bank was really actively involved in establishing this setup.
Mm-hmm.
Started in 1993 when they insisted, oh, we need an offshore banking facility which is deregulated. So it's under the mantra of deregulation, liberalization, you know, free financial markets. And so they had this Bangkok International Banking Facility suddenly established. And this this banking facility was used for launching dollar-denominated lending to Thai companies. Now, why would Thai companies take the risk of borrowing in foreign currency? They wouldn't if the central bank locally hadn't created an incentive structure so that they essentially had no choice. So what the central bank did is, first of all, it liberalized this. So it allowed companies to issue bonds and then launch them abroad or this Bangkok banking facility, borrow mm-hmm. dollar denominated. It allowed it. You know, many developing countries don't allow this. Secondly, it restricted bank credit. It restricted bank credit of the bank. So it told the Thai banks, no, Thai denominated credit has to be Thai. Then next, it raised interest rates domestically beyond the US dollar rate. And finally, it said that, oh, we have a fixed exchange rate. We have lots of foreign exchange reserves. We will make sure this fixed exchange rate will stay in place. You can rely on it. So what would a company do? A company needs money. It goes to the local bank. They say, sorry, we have tight quotas from the central bank. We can't increase lending. And even if we did, it would be at a high rate. The dollar-based interest rate is much lower. So they were all forced to essentially borrow in dollars.
Right.
And that's what they did. So suddenly you had this country, Thailand, very successful, a trade surplus, current account surplus, macroeconomic, that means an excess savings country, borrowing from abroad. There's no good reason for that. But that's this artificial situation they created. That's what they did. So they had these huge short-term somewhere more longer term, but lots of short-term borrowing from abroad in dollars. And then you just needed the trigger for that to be pulled out. And of course, the trigger was really when the Chinese currency then was devalued in around 94, Chinese export getting very, very competitive, the Thai trade surplus going down, dipping into trade deficit. And then you just mm-hmm. needed some speculators, whether it's, you know, Soros hedge fund or Julian Robertson Tiger or anyone looking at this, the foreign currency reserves going down and placing a bet, they're not going to be able to keep up that dollar peg.
So you drive them into the ground, right?
And then you drive them into account. Now, the central bank could have at any point in time said, okay, we're going to stop here. We're going to unwind this strange combination of policies. And certainly when they came to the moment where the foreign speculators were attacking the Thai baht, the currency was, you know, they had to defend it. They had to spend their FX reserve, the dollar reserve, now to defend it. It was clear that that couldn't go on forever. They should have earlier stopped it and said, okay, well, we won't keep that exchange rate and we have a moratorium on the foreign loans or something. But they didn't. They literally spent the entire dollar foreign reserves until they were gone. And then they just threw their hands up and said, well, we're bankrupt. Now we need the IMF to come in and take over. And that's what happened. So, I mean, who needs a central bank like that?
Well, I can see why the empire guys would want a central bank like that, because it gives them control of the resources and the assets and the labor of that country, ultimately, right?
Absolutely, yes, yes,
right.
Of course.
So let's talk about the really amazing example, which is the Japanese central bank. So we see Japan lose the war. We see it lose the war in something that delivered quite a shock, the bombing of two major cities. And then we see the Americans move in to occupy, leaving an occupying army that is there to this day. And then putting Japan, you know, back to shock and then squeeze in one of the longest economic squeezes. So we have an occupying army in Germany. We have an occupying army in Japan. And we're seeing extraordinary economic squeeze of both of those countries. And so you saw a lot of this through sort of unpacking what was happening in the central bank. So tell us about that shock and squeeze.
In the Japanese case, it was actually a classic central bank orchestrated credit bubble, bank credit driving asset inflation, property lending, real estate lending, also some, you know, financial asset lending. And then, you know, it's classic. You get this asset inflation continuing. Everyone seems to think, oh, we're making great money. We're very clever. We're doing so well. Tax revenues go up. Even the bureaucrats think this is wonderful. We're all doing well. The bank balance sheet, everyone's balance sheet is ballooning. Everything seems fine. But it's a house of cards, because it's, you know, you can very easily see this by simply looking total credit and then the proportion that is for transactions just to purchase assets, for bank lending, you know, to purchase assets, which doesn't contribute to GDP and therefore does not generate an income stream to reliably service and repay the loans. All you have is capital gains, but the capital gains are contingent on this Ponzi scheme to continue. You know, they will asset price will continue to go up while the central bank encouraged the banks to continue to increase lending for property purchases. So it's a perpetuum, you know, a game. I mean,
it's a speculative bubble.
Yes, in the moment, and it will last. It can last for decades. In the U.S., it lasted several decades. In Japan, it wasn't that long, but it was huge because it was, by magnitude, it was massive. It will last always until, for some reason, bank credit for asset purchases slows and stops. That's when the music stops. And then, you know, again, musical chairs, there aren't enough chairs. Everyone runs for the door, but you know, you can't get out without losses. And once you have losses, you have non-performing loans, then the banks get more risk averse, then they reduce lending, then asset prices actually go down. As they go down, you get more losses and bankruptcies and more non-performing loans. So it's a downward spiral. And then you see, the banking system is fragile because bank equity is small. It's usually only 10% or less of the bank balance sheet. And that means because, you know, when banks have non-performing loans, the sort of the hole on the asset side must come from equity.
Right.
And as you push up asset prices through this credit creation for asset purchases, by 100%, 200%, 300%, any huge amount, from the peak, it just needs to drop by 15% or maximum 20%. That'll be enough to bust the banking system, because then you've wiped out bank equity because all these assets are collateral. And it's always the same. And we've had this in so many countries and so many time periods. It was the same in the 20s in the US, of course, with margin loans on stocks. And also partly property, but mostly the margin loans and so on.
I have to tell you the story, if I haven't told you before. In the 80s, you know, basically, if you looked at central bank policy, everything was going up. And what was amazing, you would fly or drive out to the Hamptons with people from the trading desk from all over Wall Street, and they would talk about what geniuses they were. because they thought they were making money because they were geniuses. And finally, I had one partner who was constantly arguing about the traders getting big bonuses. And he did a calculation if during the most of the period in the 80s, we had simply had chimpanzees in the trading desk chairs and had run the inventories, basically, you know, taken the average inventories and the you know, the values going up in it, we would have made more money if we had chimpanzees. But everybody thought they were a genius. It's quite remarkable.
Yeah, exactly. So that's the other way you can take down a country and also reallocate ownership and cause banking crisis. And of course, what we saw in Japan is that once the banking system was bust, then the central bank is in a key position because they can make sure that if they want to, this recession will last for decades. And that's what they did in Japan. Right. On the other hand, the central bank is the one that can say, no, we're not going to have a recession. We're going to end it just like this on day one. That's also possible. It entirely depends on the central bank. And that's why they like these situations, because they're fully in charge and they can fine-tune what's going to happen, because they're sort of taken out the banking system. And that's a common thing. And there's many examples. I mean, it did the same game. So as I said, in the 20s in the US, they did it in Scandinavia in the 90s, in many countries, mm-hmm. Actually suspiciously timed, because it created a recession also in Sweden, for example, in 93 and 94. And then they held a referendum during the downturn after the property bubble had bust and the banks were bust and then there's a recession. They had a referendum on, shall we join the EU, you see? And then the narrative will be, oh, see, we're in trouble, we're in a recession. But if we join the EU, everything will be better. So they joined the EU. You know, they usually time things like that as well. And then, of course, they did the same thing was part of the Asian crisis set up again in East Asia in the 90s. And then again, even the run-up to the U.S., mortgage and dicing and slicing asset bubble peaking with the 2008 crisis is a very similar mechanism.
So one of the most famous case studies and one I've looked at a lot is Russia after the wall came down.
Yes.
So, and one of the reasons it happened was I was in London in 2000 and I was giving a paper on the way the game had been played in the United States with the mortgage fraud as of 2000 and naming some of the key investors and law firms and Wall Street firms that were doing it. And it was, I used to call it piratization. Privatization is when you privatize something at market price. When you privatize it at 10 cents on the dollar and give the private sector players a windfall, I call that piratization. Anyway, I had done a paper and Ann Williamson, who'd been in the Soviet Union when covering for the Wall Street Journal, what had happened for the first couple of years in Russia. And then John Laughlin for the Brits was covering Eastern Europe and looking at election fraud. And the three of us each gave a paper and we were in a state of shock, Richard, because we realized it's the same law firms, it's the same Wall Street firms, it's the same intelligence agency, and it's the same Harvard endowment. And Harvard was a key player in all of these places. And we realized, even though my story was about Russia, or my story was about Eastern Europe, or my story was about the United States, it's one story in one group of players. We just haven't seen it whole.
And
so I ended up looking because of Anne, and she published a series of, she had written a book but couldn't get it published in the United States, so she published it through this firm in London. But that is a very famous case, so I know you've looked at it. Tell us a little bit about what happened in Russia.
The privatization was essentially deployed so that a small number of people could gain ownership of most of Russia's assets. And that was under the guise of deregulation, liberalization, opening up, having free markets. It was very much a sellout, so that very quickly after 1990, Russia was largely foreign owned. And then the economy was not doing very well at all. It was quite a disaster. And that's when conservative elements in Russia decided, this what happened was really, the rape of Russia. And right. we want to change this. We want to win back our country. And that's what Putin basically did. He, once he came to power, step by step, he won back for Russia, for national ownership, or more widespread, you know, Russian indigenous ownership, one industry after another.
Right.
And of course, as he kept doing that, he was very methodical. He became more powerful, and then it became harder and harder for the foreign controllers to fight back. And so ultimately, he pushed them all out. And of course, by 2010, it was clear to them that they'd lost control over Russia. And so Putin was then the bad guy.
Right.
You know, that really changed, because early on, he was not really called a bad guy or anything. You know, there's lots of friendly meetings between Western leaders and Putin, the same Putin. Well, if it's the same Putin, by the way, but that's another story. But what's meant to be the same guy. And of course, then that's when, you know, the foreign and particularly U.S. interest decided, well, we need to somehow get into Russia again, get onto Russia again. They couldn't do it from the inside anymore. So they'd lost control of institutions. Interestingly, actually, in the context of what we said earlier, the central bank is somewhat, you know, has a somewhat dubious status, because the leadership seems very much in line with some of the key IMF policies. And the current governor of the Russian Central Bank is an ex-IMF employee. And
isn't the Russian Central Bank privately owned?
There is some private ownership.
Right.
I think not entirely.
It's a hybrid.
It seems to be a hybrid, but also in terms of policies, I've spoken to central banks, and they explained to me, Russian Central Bank, is that essentially it's divided into two. And one half is the IMF faction. They're very strong. They're actually largely dominant. And the other half are the ones that would take much more domestic interest-oriented policies, but they're sort of prevented from doing that. The Russian economy would have been much stronger throughout this if the central bank had not been a drag on it. And the central bank also is closing down banks, and so far is not encouraging creation of new local community banks or anything. So it's not, you know, definitely central bank policies can be improved. But it's true that essentially Putin succeeded in gaining back control over the Russian economy, apart from this, you know, this slightly blind spot concerning the central bank, but in terms of ownership of other assets and key strategic assets. That's why they then decided we need an external lever to crack open Russia. And of course, Ukraine is the lever of choice after they tried smaller places like Georgia and so on. But Ukraine has been used.
Right. So Russia defaulted in 97. And from that time on, essentially, they shut Russia out of the international bond markets. And so Russia has built back and is now not in a debt trap. It's one of the few countries in the world that's not in the debt trap.
Exactly. The Russian, the size of the national debt is minimal. It's really one of the countries with least national debt. I mean, there's some exceptions like Liechtenstein, which has zero national debt. But, you know, Russia, being a major economy, now larger than the German economy, has almost no national debt.
Right.
And at the same time, for the little debt they have, what do you get? Well, you know, Russia is the largest country in the world, and it has all sorts of resources, you know, mineral mining, natural resources of all kinds. So it's clearly a strong creditor, and Russian sovereign bonds should be much more expensive than they are. And you see, this is the discount, that is essentially a political discount put on them in Western financial markets. I mean, I do think they are attractive. The ruble is also too cheap, is artificially cheap. And the bonds, you know, I mean, Russia is not going to default of, you know, in the foreseeable decades.
So one of the things you mentioned in your notes to me was virtual alternative currencies, which serve to steal assets from a big part of the population. That's used in Eastern Europe, where you said explicit and Ponzi schemes. Tell us a little bit about the pyramid and Ponzi schemes.
The most famous one is probably the Russian one, MMM scheme, that literally issued what looked like banknotes, paper money, MMM written on it, and the issuer. It managed to build up this pyramid scheme. And really, it's literally the classic Ponzi scheme where you say that, oh, we've got this great financial technology, and, you know, just if you lend us some money, we can give you, you know, fill in the number, a very high number, depending on your inflation mm-hmm. rate, we'll be ahead of inflation. But let's say, you know, we have low inflation and you say, we'll give you 15% interest. A lot of people say, wow, 15%, that's quite good. Okay, I'll give you the money. And as they recruit more and more people, they will use the money that's actually deposited with them to pay the interest to the earlier comers. And so it's a pyramid. You constantly need to get more people to come in to pay out those who are in earlier. And so there's just the ranking. If you're in early and then you at some stage get out, you'll be a winner and money will be transferred, because it's a pure transfer. There's nothing productive about it. It's simply from the latecomers to the early insiders, transfer of wealth. But you can blow up a huge pyramid. And that's what happened in Russia. It happened in Albania, a lot of the Eastern European countries, Bulgaria, they ran schemes like that. And of course, that does remind you a little bit of some of the cryptocurrencies, right? Where essentially you have a similar scheme. I mean, you have a technology, perhaps there's even more now in terms of technology to point to than for these Eastern European schemes. And there's a promise. And of course, to some extent, there are self-fulfilling prophecies. Now, if everyone believes in them and more people come in, it will be great and can have great value. But, you know, usually there's really nothing behind it. And so you get this bubble. And then, you know, if you can't get out there, then, well, you're going to be dragged down. And
so I have to tell you, I was at a meeting. It was a political meeting somewhere in America not that long ago. And somebody came up to me who was not a Salary Report subscriber and said, oh, I've just invested in a new currency scheme. It's like the dinar. And the guy who's promoting it has made lots of money in these different schemes. So he really knows what he's doing. And I'm curious to know what you think of it. And I said, well, what's the currency? And she said, I can't remember the name. And I said, well, what's the country? She said, I can't remember that either. And I said, well, I need to know the name or the country, because I can't, it's impossible to have an opinion. So about 30 minutes later, another person comes up and says the same thing. I'm in this new currency scheme. It's like the dinar. The guy made a lot of money in dinar, so he really knows what he's doing. And, you know, I'm curious to know what you think of it. And I said, well, what's the name of the currency? And they said, you know, I don't remember. And I said, well, what country is the currency from? And they said, you know, I don't remember that either. And I thought, this can't really be happening.
Yeah, well, yes. I mean, so we do have a lot of fly-by-night operators, particularly now in the cryptocurrency scheme. There's also the, you know, the secret services being involved. This is a good way for them to raise money.
Right.
And of course, some of them have done reasonably well, and some of them are quite well established now for quite a few years. And we noticed that the mainstream media are actually essentially pushing them. It's not just Bitcoin Ethereum and Ripple. You know, they've got the whole list, and they're all, you know, Reuters, Bloomberg, they're all listing them. So, you know, there's Bankman-Fried and his scheme. And he was clearly very well connected, as we all saw.
Right.
So it's, in many ways, it is just, you know, as you say, I mean, it's these rip-off schemes, forms of financial warfare. You always, you know, you need to update, you know, what is essentially the same old game. You update it, you slightly modify it for current circumstances and for the country. And then also, as I mentioned at the beginning, you adapt to the degree of control you have of the variables, you know, depending on which country it is.
Right. So one thing you deliver is first you deliver shock. So whether it's you're dropping bombs in a war, as you did in Japan, or, you know, there's weather, a weather event, whether it's real or, you know, contrived, a pandemic, bio warfare, you know, we know, but it can be financial warfare too. It can be the central bank engineering a shock. It can be the fiscal side of the house engineering a shock. Yeah. It can be legal warfare. So there are many different ways of inducing a shock. But what you want to do is you want to throw people off balance and you want to put them in fear. And it's ideal if you can cut off their income. So a tsunami happens in Indonesia and suddenly the government figures out how to turn all the land over to hotel chains and the villagers can't come back and resettle their land. So, you know, it goes, so, you know, so there are many different ways of delivering a shock. And then there are many different tactics to grab assets. But yeah. The goal is always to increase your political and economic ownership and power. And it's very engineered. It's very planned. It's very engineered. And it's very profitable. And I think the frustrating thing for people like you and me is when it happens, because it just keeps happening, a lot of the population takes the leadership on their word. They completely fall for what, you know, whatever the narrative is to explain what's happening and why it's happening, they keep falling for the narrative.
Yeah, that's right. So
have we ever seen a place where they haven't fallen for the narrative?
Well, yes. I mean, basically, once they gain control over key institutions, including the media, then it's easy to manipulate things. In right. Europe, in the Eurozone, it's a bad situation because the ECB is in control of this huge area of Eurozone countries. It is the remodeled Reichsbank. Just like the German Reichsbank, it's an organization that's essentially has immunity, is above the law, is outside the legal framework of any European country. It's not accountable to any government. It's not accountable to any democratic assembly in the whole of Europe. And no public prosecutor, no judge can get to the central bankers. So that's an extraordinary situation. Even physically, the ECB in Frankfurt, I mean, it's located in Frankfurt, although right. technically, legally, it's not Frankfurt. It's international territory. When there was a right. fire, or there was thought to be a fire, the Frankfurt Fire Brigade wasn't allowed in because it's not Frankfurt, you see.
The ECB is an international organization that is above and outside the laws and jurisdictions of any individual nation. Its senior staff carry diplomatic passports, and the files and documents inside the European Central Bank cannot be searched or impounded by any police force or public prosecutor. The ECB is well known among economists as one of the world's most powerful and least transparent central banks. Yet its former president, Jean-Claude Trichet, dealt with this problem by merely asserting that there was no problem. The ECB is one of the most transparent central banks in the world and has helped define the state of the art of central banking in this domain, he claimed.
So one of the first demonstrations of sort of economic warfare by the ECB was against Southern Europe during the austerity period.
Yes.
And of course, one of the famous cases in this was Greece.
That's right.
And that's one you have looked at. So tell us about Greece.
Yes, Greece. And there's also Cyprus. Right. Greece. So here we have a country that had joined the Eurozone and therefore was in the hands of the ECB. And it's a great case study to see what a central bank like that can do to a country. When the government refused to sell off Greek islands and state assets, the ECB essentially said that, okay, we will then shut down your entire banking system if you don't sign here these new, you know, demands from the IMF. Essentially, there was this troika, three institutions, or in Greece they called it the katastroika, of IMF, EU, and ECB working together, squeezing Greece. And it was economic warfare, economic blackmail. They were saying, you know, if you don't sign here the dotted line and then hand over your country and your assets and so on and restrict what the government is doing, then we will shut down your banks. And they did. They literally shut down the banking system, all financial institutions, the stock exchange for, I think in total it was certainly more than 1 month. I think it was dragging into the second month. And that meant that, you know, you need some money. Well, no, the banks were shut down. So you couldn't make any transfers. You couldn't pay. Okay, good thing we have cash. Oh, hang on. I need to go to the cash point to get my cash. Well, the cash points weren't giving you cash. In fact, then they introduced, okay, we're generous. ECB decided, yes, everyone can withdraw 100 euros, I don't know in what time period, per day or every, you know, whatever time period. So there was a strict, very small maximum allowed to withdraw cash. Otherwise, there was no money. And of course, that is, I mean, if there's any economic warfare, I mean, that is a key example of economic warfare. And so in the end, the government caved in. It was subjected to this massive economic blackmail. It was similar in Cyprus, only there they went a step further and they essentially took away people's savings in the banks.
Well, didn't they do it by abrogating the deposit insurance?
Well, they essentially, for the case of Greece, they had just before in 2010 in Seoul, there was an agreement among governments and central banks that they would have bail-ins. And the argument was, well, we've tried bailout in 2008. We shouldn't do this again. Now we'll have bail-ins, which is another way of bailing out the big banks and taking money from ordinary people. It's a nice political sell. We're not going to have bailouts. We're going to have bail-ins. What it means is that depositors, that means everyone, is going to have their money directly taken away according to some formula to bail out the big banks while the small banks are being shut down. So no change there. So instead of using tax money, so it's not so painful and not so immediately visible, they're actually saying, no, we'll directly reach into your pocket and take your money that you have at the bank. And that's what they did in Cyprus. So that was pretty brutal. Now, I think the reason why they were that brutal and took away a lot of savings was because, as it so happened, you know, this is around 2010, and I mentioned earlier in the context of discussing Russia, by 2010, the foreign elites that had been trying to control Russia realized that we're out of it. And so they were starting to scheme how to get back in on Russia. And of course, we had the CIA program in Ukraine being revved up, leading to the coup d'etat staged in 2014 by the CIA to topple the elected government, bring in somebody who's pro-EU and anti-Russian. And then the discrimination of Russian speakers and ethnic Russian Ukrainian citizens. But in Cyprus, we also had a lot of Russian, you know, rich people, essentially billionaires, putting their money. Cypriot banks were quite popular with Russians. It's not that far. And, you know, they're like Greece, but Cyprus, they felt for some reason, and maybe the banks also encouraged that. They, you know, welcomed them. And so I think part of that attack on Russia was also this very harsh confiscation, particularly of larger savings that were not protected by deposit insurance. And so a lot of Russians were directly affected by that. And that probably also played into that. And you see, you know, that is also economic warfare.
So we if you watch the One Come Current, If you watch the squeeze that Japan has been in ever since, in my opinion, World War II, you know, it is extraordinary the way it has continued to this day. And part of it is what's called the carry trade. So for many years, we saw the Japanese financing U.S. hedge funds for 0%. How's that supposed to work? So the squeeze continues. And what does that mean for Japan? What's happening? Can you explain it in today's context?
Yes. So the yen is artificially weak. It's being kept weak by the central bank against the wishes of the government that wants to, you know, end this yen weakness. It's excessive weakness. It's not good for industry because Japan imports raw materials, adds value, and exports highly valued goods that don't need a weak exchange rate to be competitive. And so now they just find that their raw material imports are very, very expensive. And also, as I mentioned earlier, Japan is very cheap. Foreigners can just buy Japan. And Japanese money doesn't buy very much in the world. And so this is done partly, I mean, there's the China angle, as I mentioned, but also I think the main thrust of this is to support the dollar, because exchange rates are always relative. And the biggest globally currency pair is the yen dollar, followed by the euro. So the yen dollar rate matters by telling Japan, as the US is doing, telling the central bank, which is working with Wall Street, the Federal Reserve, to keep the yen artificially weak and keep weakening it despite the foreign exchange intervention ordered by the Ministry of Finance. The Bank of Japan is over-sterilizing that even. Despite that, therefore, the yen keeps weakening. That way, the dollar is strong. You know, a weak yen means a strong dollar.
Right.
And even though they're not quite as aggressive with the ECB on this, just by the yen being artificially weak, you are propping up the dollar. That's a policy that we've had before in the 1970s, when the U.S. defaulted on its gold obligations, major default in 1971 by Nixon, temporarily suspending what he called temporarily suspending gold convertibility. The dollar fell, and there's two things that were done about this. The first one was the U.S. told the central banks in its empire, so that includes Japan and Germany, but others as well, Bank of England, were also told to print money like crazy. Because when you do that, you are going to help the dollar. That's what they did. And that's why this inflation became a global phenomenon. It was actually to support the dollar. The second thing, of course, they did was to establish a new backing for the dollar, shifting from gold to oil, the petrodollar, by getting Saudi Arabia and also Iran, where they had regime change, to sell oil only against the US dollar. And then the next step was to hike the oil price. That was a US policy. It was actually only in January 74 that Henry Kissinger managed to persuade the Saudi Arabian oil minister to quadruple the oil price, to then, you know, transfer more wealth from Germany, Japan to the US as part of this strong dollar policy, a policy to prop up the dollar.
Yeah, the notion that the Middle East countries were getting rich, but meantime all the money was being managed over at Chase.
Exactly. Saudi Arabia had to invest 80% of its foreign exchange reserves, which were dollars, by this deal, into U.S. treasuries. And the argument was, well, you know, you get the coupons, you know, the amounts are so big, just living off the coupons will be fine for you. And so for a long time, Saudi Arabia was the biggest buyer of U.S. treasuries. And they kept that secret by, in the publications, the statistical publications, aggregating all the Middle Eastern countries together. So you couldn't see that it was really Saudi Arabia. And of course, with this stroke, with one stroke, they plugged both twin deficits.
Yeah, it was quite clever.
Yeah, yes. the current account trade deficit was plugged because you need foreign money to come in. Well, you had Saudi Arabia putting money in. And at the same time, you had overspending, all the military spending, Vietnam, you know, propping up various regimes, CIA black budgets, COVID operations everywhere, out of hand, and trillions missing, obviously, as your work has shown.
Right. And
you could, at least the official figures, you could plug the hole with this Saudi Arabian money coming specifically into U.S. treasuries and therefore plugging at the same time the budget deficit to some extent.
Right. So one of the things I've been really worried about is any kind of liquidity, any shock that causes liquidity to dry up in the dollar in the United States. So you wrote a wonderful study for Tennessee called Why Tennessee Needs a Sovereign State Bank, or Why a Sovereign State Bank Should Be Good for Tennessee. But it goes into the Germany example and talks about why, you know, a multiplicity of banks and financial institutions, as long as they're financing real economic activity, you know, produce growth without inflation. And that's what we talked about in the last interview we did with you. And of course, what we're watching now at the state level is an effort to talk states into purchasing gold and getting a gold bullion depository, but then further transactionalizing the gold so people can use gold, you know, for transactions. And of course, my fear is if the central bankers have lots of gold, the people of Tennessee or any state in the United States don't have a lot of gold, and the states don't have any. So if we suddenly wake up and we don't have dollar currency liquidity and we have to depend on gold, we're completely over the barrel. They've got us completely by the neck.
That is a risk. That is a risk. I mean, gold, I mean, it's good to have gold, have the possibility of using gold and gold-based, you know, transactions. But there is that risk. And of course, that's the one I've always emphasized because, and that's why I always point out to people who talk about the gold standard as being the best way of organizing things. Well, actually, there's never been a gold standard because of this problem that there isn't enough gold.
Right.
As a result, when there was a so-called gold standard, in reality, there was always bank credit creation. In a way, you could say it's like, you know, expanding your gold supply, if you want, in a virtual way. And that's what banks do. They expand the money supply. Now, you can, of course, use gold as an anchor. But as long as we have community banks, we're not limited by this. And ultimately, you know, gold is an alternative, but it's one that has these restrictions and potential risks because, you know, we don't control so much gold. That's why we at the same time need to establish and strengthen and create more community banks, local community banks, because it's a flexible, you know, basically community bank is a technology that's flexible. One can incorporate gold accounts. One can say, okay, we go back to a system where it's like a kind of fractional reserve of gold with gold deposits. We could also have gold certificates. But you can also use other things if you feel that, okay, well, it's better now for a certain time period to not rely on gold as the main thing. We want to expand credit. It can be based on anything. Just bank credit, digital units. You could even go back to the old system of the split tally that was used 1,000 years ago, introduced by the Normans to England, and then used for 700 years. You know, you mentioned Bitcoin. Bitcoin has a public key and a private key, which is a bit like, you know, the old system of tally sticks, which they used to have. Here's one. Uh-huh. They used to have this in the Norman Exchequer in England. It was in place actually for 800 years. And you have notches here to denote a particular amount. This is 2,123 pounds and a few pennies.
Wow.
And then it was split. And the short one is the foil, which is kept in the Royal Treasury. The long one was the stock, which circulated as evidence that you've paid your taxes. And because of that, could be used in the Exchequer as tax
evidence that you've paid taxes. It was therefore used as money, and the government could go out and spend with this. It was forgery proof because, of course, with money, the important thing is, you know, can it be forged right. or not? But it's like a fingerprint, you know, the grain right. in the wood, the grainage is unique. And if you wanted to check, they fit together, then they tallied. And if the foil did not match the tally stick, the stock, then you were foiled. And so this is where our expressions right. come from, including the expression for the check, because there was a big chessboard-sized abacus, uh-huh. After which the exchequer is named. And that's where the word check comes from, which was used for the calculations for the system. So this is a monetary system, and it's like Bitcoin, public key, mm-hmm. private key, where you check whether they fit together. So it can be paper, it can be wood, it can be just an Excel spreadsheet on, say, the local right. mayor's, town mayor's computer, maybe sealed off from the internet, and right. everyone has their name in there, and you can just create tax credits and shift them around and have bookings. So there's many, many possibilities.
One of the best times of the year is watching you explain to the Tennessee treasurer with your tally sticks how the tally system worked. That was fascinating.
It is fascinating. And it just shows you, you know, it's just a piece of wood. It's hazel wood, a stick, hazel wood, but it can be your monetary system. So, it's, right. you know, as long as there's a clever idea, we can turn anything into money, into credit.
Right. Well, the thing that makes an economy go is enterprise, is people doing useful products and services and building enterprise.
Exactly.
And that needs transactional liquidity.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And you can use anything.
Exactly, right? Exactly. And right. of course, by having community banks, you have all the ingredients. You already have counterparties, you have customers, you have savers, you have borrowers. And then you could quickly switch to some other currency if you need to. You could issue right. a local currency if you wanted to issue a new local currency. Anything is possible because you have that technology. Essentially, a community bank is about the community. And because right. they are embedded in the community and accountable to the community, the community can use them as a flexible response to whatever shocks they may throw at us.
So one of the things I love about the piece that you created for Tennessee is you make it clear you cannot permit the consolidation of the banking system.
Yes.
That cannot the you know, a healthy, diversified, decentralized banking system is the basis of independent income. And independent income is the basis of freedom.
Indeed.
And if you shrink those two things, game over.
Exactly. And of course, that leads us to the other topic we mentioned in earlier discussions, and I'm sure we have to return to again, which is the reality that the central planners are concentrating financial systems. Right. They right. want to reduce the number of banks. They encourage takeovers of banks by banks so that total number of banks decreases. Because that increases the concentration, their control, and reduces our possibilities. And of course, one way to accelerate that is the introduction of central bank digital currency, which we also have to fiercely oppose. Right. That is a highly concentrated technology.
Right. Although I think if you look at the fast payment systems, Richard, I don't know if you've ever looked at the World Bank as sort of rolling out and overseeing fast payments systems worldwide. But I think with fast payment systems, credit cards, and banking systems, in theory, you could do that kind of control without CBDCs. I don't think they have to use CBDCs.
Yes, that's right. But it seems their preference to reduce the right, number right. of banks. And that's the reason is that while we still have banks, we can easily switch to another technology if we want to. See? It's, right. it's a more flexible system to make sure that small local banks continue to exist, which is why I think we should make sure we keep our local banks and support them.
So I want to, yeah, well, that's one thing, as you've said many times, I've said many times, just shifting your deposits to good local banks and, you know, shifting that state of play or keeping cash and checks alive, just keeping the system as non You know, we can't permit all digital. So that is very helpful. But speak to me now. I want you to put on Mr. Global's hat, because if you look at your experience, both private, public, academic, you know, clearly you can think about this from Mr. Global's point of view. So you've just done a shock and awe with the Going Direct reset. So you've shut down Main Street. You've injected $5 trillion in the U.S. and more in the ECB into Wall Street. They've gone on a shopping spree. You know, you clearly have within the United States a land grab going on. If you were Mr. Global and you wanted to continue this, you're deindustrializing Germany. You've got the shock going. What do you do next?
Well, when you run out of options to, you know, to exploit other countries in a sort of post-colonial relationship, whether it's, you know, eating out the German German manufacturing sector, deindustrializing Germany, shifting factories even to the U.S., back to the U.S., if you're running out of countries, you can debauch and gouge and sort of cannibalize, then warfare is the next option, isn't it? So at some stage, once you've tried all the different versions of economic and financial warfare, it's the hot real war that comes back in, and then after that you start from scratch again, isn't it? That's the sort of cycle. And of course that is the big threat at the moment, that there seem to be a lot of people interested in pushing Russia into a third world war. And really, we don't need another world war. We don't need a nuclear war.
So let me bring something up, because we've been, John Titus and I have been following this pretty closely. And you just, I don't know if you saw the Hungarian foreign minister announce at the NATO meeting, you know, basically you guys are trying to start a war and get us all in according to Article 5. And that's insane. So we had Hungary at least speaking reality to the NATO meeting. But from everything I can see, if you look at the planning in Germany, France, and NATO in Europe, and the planning in the United States, no one has built significant military capacity, whether men or armaments, to really take on the Russian army. And so if you do what they're sort of angling to do, you know, slithering into a World War III, you know, it's almost an intentional plan to start a war that they intend to lose. They can't win a land war.
I think that is the case. It is. There's no way the West is going to win against Russia. And it seems that some people are keen to get it nuclear very quickly anyway, to have maximum destruction, to then have a reset, which seems insane. I mean, it is insane, basically. And we have to be very much aware of that risk. And yes, definitely, what we should all demand is, well, let's have peace negotiations everywhere in the world, because this warfare is not a solution.
But it looks to me like they think they can win by losing a war. Is that possible, that they can achieve, you know, even more equity ownership? I mean, they can achieve depopulation, but how do they win economically from losing a war?
Well, it's probably not rational, not entirely rational. I think there is a spiritual angle here, because some people are, like, in a very unhealthy way, insanely keen on having this very destructive warfare, which ordinary people would always think this is crazy, and it is crazy. And so we can't imagine that there's some people that are really excited by this prospect. by having dramatic big resets and having mass killings and annihilation of entire populations and so on. Because some sort of mentally ill people, I mean, it is a kind of sociopathic, pathological inclination, feel that this creates opportunities. That sort of seems to be the mindset, which of course is crazy, but we have to be aware there are people like that out there, and they seem to be far too influential, really. So perhaps, yeah, that's it is a sort of slightly negative tone to end this on, but I would therefore point out that there's a lot we can do, and we need to speak up. I think it's very important, and I'm always encouraged by speaking up. I think we have achieved quite a few things, and you know what we have achieved is that the introduction of central bank digital currencies has been rolled back. I think they wanted it earlier. It's been delayed. They will try to roll it out in industrialized countries, likely in Europe first. But if we continue to resist, and more people are waking up and resisting, then we can push it further back, and they have to come up with alternative mechanisms. Likewise, you know, on the war topic, I think we just have to speak up. It is insane, and we have to let them know this is insane. You know, we're peaceful. We'd like peace. We think there should be immediate, you know, ceasefires and cessation of military conflict. We need to discuss. We need negotiations.
As you know, I tend to be an optimist, so I'm optimistic. And one of the reasons I'm optimistic is I'm finally beginning to see a critical mass of highly capable, intelligent people with positions and resources realizing that they're that insane. It's kind of like, okay, demonic versus divine. I get it. There's something demonic going on here. So I think the sane have decided to gather because they've realized the insane really are insane. And that's very positive. They're getting their state of amusement back about the whole thing. And I think that's very positive. And we've seen in the United States an tremendous pushback this year that's been very successful. So you have the treasurers, the attorney generals, all sorts of legislative state and local officials getting together, working together, and just, you know, busting through on many different issues. So I'm with you. I see the gathering. I also see more people using cash and checks and doing all these various things. And, you know, we even had Powell 4 weeks ago say we're not even remotely close to doing CBDC. Now, he's lying through his teeth, but it's the first time I saw Powell, you know, forced into a lie, which means he's, you know, we are making progress. So I guess what to me, one of the most important things that needs to happen to continue to push back is we need to wipe out the big lies. And one of the big lies I see is that the elites are, or Mr. Global is doing this because the economy is about to collapse and this is what he has to do to keep it going. Now, I think that's one of the big lies. And it's funny because I saw a great discussion between you and David Webb, where David was trying to say, Mr. Global's protecting against this big collapse. And I'm, you know, and you and I are saying, no, that's not how it works. So one of the big lies is that we can't have a plentiful, resourceful, wealthy, you know, that there isn't a real alternative. And of course there is. And that's what I love about your work and the speech you gave in Malmo or the interview we just did.
It's possible that even if you have to have CBDC, in some form, that you're not destroying the banking system. If you do it the way China is doing it, now you have to remember China only recently introduced their banking system, and it seems they were not willing to already give it up. They have already CBDC. It's still a pilot project, but it's introduced, you know, among millions of people already. But it was introduced on purpose in such a way that it would not harm the banking system, and therefore is a more truthful sort of update of the old paper money. But of course, it still has the control aspect. So at least it's not killing the banking system. The way they do this is by requiring you to have a bank account in order to get CBDC. So it's not a direct account at the central bank. It's only through your bank that you can get it. You see how simple that is? And of course, could be done over here, but they're not discussing it say the ECB is not discussing it, because you see their agenda is to get rid of banks. But this alternative exists. But then, of course, the key problem is this control aspect, which at the moment they haven't stepped up in China, but that can be introduced any time. And that, of course, is a concern. Also, they never talk about the nature of this CBDC. What is it actually going to look like? They never talk about that. Right. But I heard one European central banker tell me what it's going to look like. He saw it. He was invited to one of the old central banks in Europe that are very much promoting this. And they showed him. And, you know, he's a top, executive director of another central bank in Europe. And there's no reason to believe that he was telling me a story. And he was around this large and would be implanted under your skin. So that is the plan. And of course, that has other implications on top of what we've mentioned, on top of the control aspects, because that actually enters your body. In my view, violates human dignity, and can be then used for even in terms of functionality beyond the monetary and economic transaction purposes. So highly dangerous, and definitely something we have to oppose. And so using cash is one of the things we can do to make sure that the hurdle will be higher for the central planners to introduce the CBDC.
So I think there are big lies that have to get killed. I also think one of the things that needs to get killed is this notion that these takings keep happening through market forces as opposed to planning and engineering. And that's why I wanted to do this interview. I wanted to have some, you know, because you can see the game because you're both scholar and an investment person and, you know, private sector person, you know, and you understand the public side as well. So you see the game and you're not, you know, you don't think, oh, well, you know, the market just crashed in East Asia. That's not how it works, right?
Yes,
So I think, you know, one of the things we see is fierce opposition to the WHO treaty or the WHO amendments. The treaty comes next, but fierce opposition. And I think that fierce opposition is coming, you know, in part because people are now beginning to see this. They're now beginning to see it's a taking machine. It's not health rules and regulations. It's a machine designed to take our assets. So one author said the other day, we finally figured out climate change is just a cudgel you use to hit us over the head, steal our assets, and kill us. Anyway, okay, well, this has been a great conversation, Richard. Any other advice you have if you were going to look at case studies to help you understand sort of how the game works and how it gets played, any other case studies you would point us to?
Well, you can always go back in history because, you know, the game has been played many times before. Also in the past, the game of regime change, you know, mm-hmm. governments don't play ball. Soon there's a revolution, regime change. That's been done many times over. The other component of these games is controlled opposition. The British have been very good at that, running their empire, by making sure that all their opponents are their agents, right. And so on. So it's always the same tricks. But yeah, as you say, I mean, we can now see through this. And the truth is, we don't have to do any of this. We don't have to allow any of this. Right. We can have abundance and prosperity. And so let's go and demand it and implement it.
Right. But it requires the rule of law. One last thing you did bring up that I forgot to mention is your reference to the Greek bonds. And I'm thinking of it because I keep thinking of, I haven't asked you about the Credit Suisse workout, which was astonishing and breathtaking, in that you have, you know, different creditors given different rights, totally outside the law. It's just let's make up whatever we want to do here.
That's what they did in Greece, yes, which was quite shocking. You mentioned Credit Suisse. I mean, there is actually one particular Credit Suisse episode, which again recently had this episode where they, you know, it disappeared now. It's been usurped and taken up by, you know, incorporated into UBS. So it ceased to exist. But in 2008, when Credit Suisse was in trouble, it demonstrated to all of us that you never need taxpayers' money. When a bank is in trouble, you can just allow the bank to take care of the accounting problem, which a banking crisis is, it's just an accounting problem, on its own, which is what they did. The Credit Suisse created its own capital.
Mm-hmm. Did it make a loan to itself?
Well, you need a straw man, you need a counterparty, so they and it needs to be big. So they had the Sovereign Wealth Fund of Qatar. And they lent Qatar, they needed 10 billion more capital. So step one, get a counterparty who can borrow that money from you. So they persuaded the Qatari sheikh to borrow 10 billion from them. They did refund the interest as well. That's the thing the public prosecutors then looked into because it was a sideshow. And then, so then the bank creates the money. The balance sheet lengthens, the borrower's account is credited with the newly created deposits, and you get the borrower to buy your shares, and you have 10 billion more in capital. That's what they did. Of course, Barclays did the same, and in the UK, this is specifically illegal according to the Companies Act. So everyone was sort of sidestepping that issue, and the Serious Fraud Office wasn't really keen to look into it. And then these banks didn't need bailouts. You know, you see, right. It works, can be done. Because you see, when you have non-performing loans, the loss was already earlier when the wrong loans were given. That's when the losses happened.
Right.
It doesn't make sense to add further losses, including a recession and unemployment, to the old losses. Doesn't make sense. So it always does make sense to just get rid of these things through some clever accounting or the central bank getting involved. And so, there are ways out without the economic cost, because ultimately we can have abundance.
Right. And I think it's fair to say there's an old movie going around that keeps having everybody say this, all wars are bankers' wars. Is that fair?
Yes. Yeah, I suppose so.
Indeed. Okay, Richard, I can't thank you enough for joining us again. And we're going to make case studies part of the first quarter wrap up, where we're looking at all the different things the state can do. And I want to thank you again for coming all the way to Tennessee. And
it was great. It was a pleasure. I really enjoyed that. I hope I'll be able to come again soon.
I'm sure you will. I think some of the legislators really enjoyed meeting you. They learned a tremendous amount. And we got the message across about how important it is to keep that currency liquidity going. So, okay, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us on the Solari Report. Have a wonderful day.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.